from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Mina Kim. The Women's March broke records as one of the largest protests in American history. More anti-Trump protests are planned for later this month on Tax Day and the March for Science on Earth Day. But do street protests really do anything? For those who oppose President Trump, what are the most effective ways to resist his agenda? And how are those who support Trump pushing back? What makes an effective, sustainable protest movement today? That's coming up on Forum. Join us after the news. From KQED News, Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Mina Kim.
Hit! Not my president! Not my president!
They can't take our immigrants away from us. And I'm willing, as an 85-year-old man, to stand in any doorway where we have to stand to keep them from taking a family approach.
Mass protests look like they may become a fixture of Donald Trump's presidency. The president's first day in office saw the massive Women's March in Washington, D.C., and in cities across America. Liberal activists plan to take to the streets again on Tax Day, April 15th, to pressure Donald Trump to release his tax returns. So far, he has not. And there's a March for Science. Science is Real protest planned for Earth Day 1 week later. Trump's policies on women, immigration, refugees, and more have prompted millions to get off the couch and into the streets. Many of them are first-time protesters. Others are taking a different approach. There's the ongoing boycott of retailers that sell Trump family products or companies whose executives support Trump. Other activists are encouraging dissenters to run for political office, any office. Protest and dissent in the age of Trump. In this hour's forum, join the conversation. What forms of protest are most effective? What kind of dissent is sustainable over the long term? Do large marches actually do anything, or do they just make people feel good? Join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. That's the topic for this forum hour this morning. We want to hear from you. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Joining us for the hour from New York City is artist, writer, and activist Avram Finkelstein. He created the iconic Silence Equals Death logo and slogan that became a rallying cry for the AIDS advocacy group ACT UP. He's now active in helping to shepherd a new generation of activists in the anti-Trump group Rise and Resist. Avram Finkelstein, welcome to Forum.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Also with us from New York is writer and activist L.A. Kaufman, author of the new book, Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism, about the history of protest movements, which kinds have worked, which have fizzled, and why. L.A. Kaufman, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
L.A., I want to start with you. I mean, three big marches potentially in just 3 months in office for President Trump. I mean, is that really sustainable to remain kind of red-hot white marches every other month? I mean, that's a lot to keep going over time.
It certainly is, but we're seeing, I think, a really unusual level of activation and energy right now. I've been very impressed by not just the scale of the protests that we've seen, but the real seriousness of purpose that I see people bringing to this work. I see people thinking and talking about the need to pace themselves and think about the long run. Obviously, you can't get a crowd the size of the Women's March mobilized on a routine basis. Those kind of big mobilizations are like punctuation in the longer-term work. But I think the energy levels are quite extraordinary.
The energy and the enthusiasm is there. Avram Finkelstein, in New York City, you're a veteran of ACT UP, and you're involved now in Rise and Resist. Are you seeing the energy and enthusiasm there as well in New York, or are you concerned about maintaining that intensity over the long haul?
No, I think it's definitely here. I'm not concerned about maintaining it. I think I tend to take a lifer's approach to this. Resistance is a lifelong endeavor. It doesn't dismantling institutions of hegemony and power isn't something that there's one answer to. You don't all of a sudden you know, I think the impulse after Trump was elected was like, oh, my God, how can I fix this right now? But that isn't at all the way resistance and protest movements function. They're very long-haul projects. They're multilevular. They're interdisciplinary. So I think one of the most interesting things I've noticed in the LGBTQ community in particular is over the last few years, there's been such a strong compulsion to intergenerationality that we're really well poised to think about this and in this way. And Rise and Resist is a perfect example where there are tribal elders, if you will, doing CD training, people who did the CD trainings that
Civil Disobedience.
Who CD trained me. Civil Disobedience, yes, thank you.
There's some
and
of the exact same
were,
folks, Abram, yeah?
That the exact same folks. Yeah, the people whose civil who did my civil disobedience and martial trainings in ACT UP are still doing it at Rise and Resist. And then you have young people who come out of Occupy and are bringing a whole other set of skills and perspectives to it.
Abram, President Trump is very good at public relations. He's good at marketing. He knows how to throw a punch. How do you take the lessons of ACT UP, the Grand Fury Collective that you founded, and Silence Equals Death, and use those tools to counter his message, ideas, plans, and policies? This is a social media president who not only can throw a punch, he likes to punch back.
Yeah, in fact, it's the only thing he's good at. And I have been thinking and writing and speaking a lot about image literacy in the 21st century, which is distinctly different, and we've just been offered up the first reality television presidency that's built entirely on the fumes of the internet content machine. But I think that people are looking in the wrong direction when they look at Trump. They're applying theories and language and ways of thinking about inside the Beltway DC politics to somebody who's came up through reality television. And I think the whole matrix of Trump is that he's not actually interested in running the country. He's running a brand. And the brand was firmly established long before he ever ran for office. So I think we need to think that way about it.
That's a valid point. I mean, but the social media matrix for political organizing is different from, I don't know, the wonky policy stuff that you might need to also affect change over time.
That's right, and I think it's a hand-in-glove situation. I'm an activist who thinks that there's no form of political engagement that is futile or not relevant. All of it is, and I think it has to work in concert. So let the wonks wonk and the policy people do that and the street activists do that. But I think that, again, the matrix for Trump has much more in common with Kim Kardashian than he does with Paul Ryan.
Well, we're talking about protest, dissent, and activism in the age of Trump. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're getting a lot of comments, including Stephanie, who writes in, "The Women's March was amazing, but it didn't result in anything at all. No legislation, no focus. It's all but forgotten now." L.A. Kaufman, to that point, large marches can make people feel good, and that could be important, mobilizing, energizing a feeling that they're doing something. But legislatively, politically, throughout history, have they had a large impact?
Well, I think large marches are typically misunderstood as being first and foremost a pressure tactic. That's really not what they are. It's really not what they do. We have this image in our head that's based partly on mythologized histories of the civil rights movement, where we think, oh, people marched on Washington in 1963, and that brought about the moral change in the nation and the groundswell of popular support that led to the Civil Rights Act and to progressive legislation. And to the extent that that tale is even true about the civil rights movement, it is not really the way that most of our large mobilizations work. They are much more important as a movement-building tactic than they are as a pressure tactic. And from that point of view, I think the Women's March was extremely successful. It was successful first and foremost in really breaking a spell of fear that it already now is just a few months ago, but if you remember in that period between the election and the inauguration, a lot of people were depressed. A lot of people were really feeling paralyzed. A lot of people withdrew from public engagement. And the Women's March was like a coming out party for the resistance, a moment where we took strength and encouragement from each other. I think, you know, that there's a lot of questions to be asked about what kind of roots will be put down from that. And the organizers have been doing some smart things. They've had a whole series of concrete steps for people to take in the wake of the Women's March, including they had more than 5,000 small group meetings called huddles that were based in part on the model of the consciousness-raising groups of the late 60s and early 70s when the Women's Liberation Movement first took off. So there's a lot that's been happening since January 21st that's just not visible in the same way because it's not big crowds in the street.
Fair point. Paul tweets at us, what makes a protest effective? One message and an organization that's taken responsibility for the behavior of the protesters, nonviolence and paid permits, things like that. Abram, ACT UP was not about getting paid permits. They were about nonviolence, but it was in-your-face activism that was new and different and got attention, whether it was blocking streets or storming the National Institutes of Health. But talk about that listener's comment that protest movements do have to take responsibility for the more extreme elements. I'm thinking particularly of the Black Bloc movement that sometimes has smashed windows, broken stores, set fires, and committed other acts that can make the rest of those in the street look bad.
Yeah, I might be the wrong person to actually agree with or side with this particular comment, although I think it's a really fair one to make. And I do think going back to your previous question to LA about the large marches, I think that her analysis is completely accurate. Movements are actually built incrementally over long periods of time. And in fact, the silence equals death. The silence equals death poster, which is deployed as the logo of ACT UP, the symbol of ACT UP, was actually designed by a six-person collective a year before ACT UP existed, and it was a collective built on consciousness-raising principles that came out of the women's movement, PS. So I think the ways in which we think about social movements are very different from the way they are actually enacted, and I would say about the Million Person March, it does create the feeling of safety. You feel, whether you're there or not, that there are millions of people who agree with you, and that makes you feel safe. But from a strategic perspective, picture those million or 3 million people broken into groups of four and five acting independently over a 10-year period with an ongoing campaign of affinity group actions that some of which you may never have heard of. That can be equally as effective. I think we're trained to gauge things by the larger impacts that they make on a social, on our social landscape, but that doesn't mean that the things you don't ever see have no meaning.
We're joined now by Mark Anthony Johnson. He's with the Movement for Black Lives and the Director of Health and Wellness at Dignity and Power Now. Mark Anthony Johnson, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much for having me.
So talk a little bit about your movement in post-election. What is the Movement for Black Lives focused on now that President Trump is in office?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I want to say thank you for this conversation. It's always really important that we keep talking about what social movements and how important they are to the country and to the development of some really basic values around democracy, around safety, around health, and, you know, Movement for Black Lives, which is a national umbrella of many organizations, including Black Lives Matters, including BYP 100, including Million Hoodies, and also local organizations like Dignity and Power Now in Los Angeles, looking at a lot of different things, specifically police violence, which has been a really, really important conversation, over the last 8 years. And even beyond that, consent decrees have been a really important tool for folks to try and leverage some attention and some level of change in local law enforcement. And we're seeing, the Department of Justice taking an active role in reviewing the utility of those things. And while consent decrees are not the end-all, be-all, what they signal is some way for local jurisdictions to be held accountable on a federal level. Mm-hmm. And what Movement for Black Lives has been saying as one of its many angles that we're taking on is that we really want communities to have local control and power when it comes to holding police accountable, when it comes to resources that are used to establish public safety mechanisms in our own communities. And so we're seeing a really, really continued movement to really lean into this conversation around public safety and the way in which law enforcement affects our lives. But you can see other issues as well in terms of immigration, continuing to push the conversation for us to think about the ways in which deportations and criminalization affects undocumented people, and specifically Black undocumented people, in alliance with all of our folks, Black Muslims, Afro-Latinos as well. And so many of these issues that we're seeing right now are really, really critical to the work that's happening across the country.
But I did want to ask, I mean, there was a lot of attention on the police-involved shootings of unarmed Black men about Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, and others. And, it is reasonable to say that some of that has shifted in terms of the limelight in the wake of the election. We've got President Trump's controversial travel ban proposals, his controversial nominations, now missile strikes on Syria. I guess I'm curious, how and in what ways are you working to get the focus back in your organization, Movement for Black Lives?
Well, what we've been saying is that the Movement for Black Lives launched a policy platform last year, which looked at several categories in which we think it'd be important to create radical and transformative change, looking at ending the war on Black people, looking at reparations, looking at budgets, for really trying to determine how safety and wellness and dignity actually translates into resources and structure in our communities. And so some of the things that you'll see and what we've been saying is that the trends around law enforcement violence didn't change because the limelight is changing, right? In Los Angeles, Los Angeles is the deadliest county in the country. In fact, the two deadliest law enforcement agencies in the country exist in Los Angeles, and that's the Los Angeles Police Department and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And so we're actively moving to really expose the ways in which these trends continue and make the connection between not just what's the violence that's happening on the front end of our folks, but people who survive law enforcement interactions and end up in jails, end up in prisons. And so some of the conversation that you're seeing right now is looking at bail reform and really challenging on a national level to how can we really change the system, which is criminalizing and housing folks, many Black people across the country, for not being able to pay their bail, and the large impacts that's connected to that in terms of loss of housing, loss of families, loss of jobs. And so the violence that comes from the law enforcement interaction is not simply connected to whether someone is shot or whether someone is beaten, but there's so many other things that we are trying to draw the spectrum on and address and create some real transformative visionary changes on all fronts.
Let's go to some callers now. We're talking about dissent activism and protest in the age of Donald Trump. Melinda, in Albany, you're on the air. What's your question or comment for our guests?
I just have a quick comment. Since the election results, my son and I, 12-year-old, have decided to resist in some form every day. And we've never really been politically active, but since then we've helped to establish a small community group. And this group has been able to make some changes in city policy and create a sanctuary city for our community and also safety in district. We've also, in light of the recent hate crime that's happened in our district, we were able to facilitate a restorative justice meeting between the parents involved. So I just want to say that day by day, step by step, we know it's a long haul, but it does pay off to be involved in your community.
Fair comment. Thanks for your call. Amy in Los Altos, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks for taking my call so quickly. So about the protests, I say a couple things. One is that to me they are like a wedding. They are like symbolic and a ritual that's for some people important to take part in. But what really matters is the wedding and what people do afterward. It's about sustained action and having a long-time movement. And one of the things, I'm the national board chair for an organization called Emerge America that recruits and trains women to run for office. We have seen since the election, women are just furious because of electing, supposedly, certainly the most sexist, overtly sexist president we've ever seen. And we are being flooded with women wanting to run, which is the kind of activism you need to have for sustained action. And on the grassroots level, we're seeing that the women who are, the people who are making the majority of calls to their representatives and taking those kinds of action, the vast majority are women, which, of course, there are a lot of men, but women are really motivated. And one of the things that they can do is they can consider running for office at any level. You have to start somewhere. And if not you, then who's going to do it?
Emerge America and Run for Something is another organization that's doing that. L.A. Kaufman in New York, to you on that point about affecting change over the long term, we get one listener and sort of piggybacking on the caller we just heard from who said, you know, look, ACT UP, Rise and Resist, and Occupy haven't really accomplished anything. By comparison, a true grassroots movement is the Tea Party, he says, which resulted in the largest political change in American history in 2010. The forum listener has a valid point there, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, there's lots of ways to gauge what kind of change a movement has made, and
he's talking about people who've actually got political change, have power, been elected, Congress, local.
Right. I mean, he's talking specifically about electoral work, and I think there's a fair point to be made that I think that the left held electoral work at too much of an arm's length at various points in the past. There have been a lot of times when our movements have found it easier to work in an outsider protest mode than to think about how to bring those values and some of that energy into the electoral realm. And the kind of things that I see happening as part of this broad, sprawling resistance movement that we have right now, you know, it's the range of those two previous callers, Melinda and Amy. We're seeing, you know, people doing that kind of local work in their communities, forming their local community groups that are going to be ongoing pressure groups. And we're seeing people engaging in the electoral process in a new way, whether it's through groups like Indivisible that are pressuring their elected officials, or this whole new wave of people running for office.
All right, stay with us. We're coming up on a break. Mark Anthony Johnson, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So we'll continue the conversation, protest dissent in the age of Trump, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Eric Westerveld, sitting in for Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Eric Westerveld, sitting in for Mina Kim. We're talking about protest dissent in President Trump's era. What does it take to sustain a lasting protest movement? We want to hear from you. What do you think counts as an effective form of protest today? What do you think is doing a good job? And what's your own personal chosen form of protest? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. You can email your questions as well to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Again, 866-733-6786. And we're joined now by Shannon Coulter. She's co-founder of Grab Your Wallet, a boycott movement that compiles a list of companies that have financial ties to the Trump family or whose executives are supporting the Trump family. Shannon, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So talk a little bit about your form of protest. You are a career marketing executive. How did you get involved in trying to create a boycott movement against Donald Trump?
Right. It sort of came out of the blue. It was back in October in the wake of the release of the Trump tapes, the infamous hot mic remarks Donald made in 2005 to Access Hollywood. And I was just looking for a way to respond to that. It took shape very, very quickly. I found a woman online who was thinking along the same lines as I was, which was a boycott. Her name's Sue Atencio, also a Californian. And together we just joined forces and announced that same evening that we were launching the boycott. At the time, it was just a screenshot of a list of 10 to 12 retailers, which has since grown considerably. Hmm. And it really took off from there.
Tell us a little bit about your metric for success. Are you looking at sales going up or down? Are you looking at stock price? Or are you looking at just getting these companies off your list? What's your metric and measurement for success of this boycott?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's some data to suggest that boycotts don't really operate at the level of, you know, month-to-month sales numbers. They operate more at the brand or PR level. So our primary metric of success is the number of companies that have ended their ties to the Trump family. And that's that number for our movement so far is 23, including many publicly traded companies like Nordstrom, who have gone on the record and said, we're not going to do business with this family anymore. And then the other metrics we look at are just, you know, how many times has the hashtag been seen? How many website visits do we get? And those numbers are not like any numbers I've ever seen in my career as a digital marketer. Hmm. The hashtag's been seen over 900 million times now. And for a tiny little, you know, one-person show, essentially, the organization, Grab Your Wallet, the website got 2 million visits in February, which, you know, is great for a little tiny shoestring operation.
Yeah, not bad for an organization. You don't have a budget, correct me if I'm wrong, or a staff right now?
Right, right. We're all grassroots right now, although we are considering the possibility of forming a nonprofit.
Hmm. Let's take some calls. We're talking about dissent, protest in the age of Donald Trump. Wynn from Menlo Park, you're on the air for Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm worried that a lot of this energy is going to be misplaced because we're arguing with a man who doesn't listen to anybody except his children or Steve Bannon, and he's in office for 4 years. Why don't we focus on the 3 votes that we need in the Senate to change and the 25 votes that we need in the House and put all our energy there, because then he'd be hamstrung if he loses Congress.
Interesting point. L.A. Kaufman in New York, author of Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. You want to take that in terms of strategy?
I mean, I don't want to discount the importance of trying to flip the Senate. Obviously, those electoral races are hugely important. But in the near term, I think that the work that the various protest movements have done in helping delegitimize this administration, in helping create an atmosphere of crisis and contestation around everything they do, has already had a quite powerful effect. A lot of it has been the negative effect of holding off plans that might otherwise have been implemented. We know that Steve Bannon came into that White House with a much more aggressive agenda than the one that he's been able to push. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, so far, you know, initiative after initiative of Trump's is falling into political crisis, from his Muslim ban to his Trump care health care bid. And I think the protest movements have been an important part of that happening and creating this just overall atmosphere that makes it very difficult for him to pursue his agenda in a linear fashion.
We're getting a lot of questions and comments on social media, on Twitter and Facebook. Ben asks, who are the leaders of these new movements? It seems the protest movements in the past 15 years, he says, have been leaderless and therefore rudderless. Abram Finkelstein, ACT UP and Grand Fury, they were kind of leaderless in many ways. Talk a little bit about leadership and whether that's important or not, and your lessons from ACT UP.
Well, Grand Fury and ACT UP are distinctly different. Grand Fury was a closed collective with roughly 11 members. It started out way more than that, but it winnowed down to 11. And ACT UP was pretty much a revolving door. Whoever came into the room was a part of that, the organizing principles mm-hmm. behind that organization. I do think that the idea of leaders is somewhat antithetical to my experience within grassroots organizing. And I should say I was stuffed envelopes for the Poor People's Campaign when I was a teenager. And my first job was making strike T-shirts. And I was active in the Student Mobilization Committee. So I've seen a lot of things go down. But I don't I think the idea of leadership is hierarchical. And one of the, as LA was pointing out, like the tensions between electoral politics or metrics for marketing are very much involved in hierarchical conversations and hierarchical gauges. But I think that protest is actually a distinctly different thing. I think resistance is not a thing at all. In fact, it's not an object. It's not even an objective. It's a project. It's an ongoing project. And even though it might die the second you put it down, the second someone else picks it up, it's alive again.
Joining us now is Brendan Steinhauser. He's co-founder and partner at Steinhauser Strategies. He's a Republican strategist who years ago was part of a group called Freedom Works, a group that Dick Armey credited with helping give rise to the Tea Party movement. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you've said that liberals stole your Tea Party playbook. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's kind of funny. I think that we stole their playbook first, and then they stole it back recently. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was at Freedom Works and the Tea Party movement was really just a sentiment at the time. It was a feeling of opposition to big government, to Wall Street bailouts, to the stimulus program in 2009. You know, we had studied social movements, mass political movements in history, and had always found that, for whatever reason, conservatives never took to the streets and protested. And the left is pretty good at that. They had the history of the anti-war movement in particular in the 1960s and 70s, which turned out, you know, millions of people over time to protest the Vietnam War and other issues. And so that was a big change for conservatives, was to get them to actually go out and protest in the streets. And then the challenge became, how do we sustain that momentum and then get involved in elections?
Well, you know, it's funny because Max writes in, where were all these activists last November? All this is just talk, empty talk, get out and vote. And the Tea Party, one could argue, did just that. They said, you know, we're not going to take to the streets. We're going to take to local towns, PTAs, local Senate races, House races, and the Tea Party has been effective.
Sure. You know, I think what's interesting, too, is that I do think there are a lot of people in this latest kind of movement more on the left, there are many people who are new to politics who maybe did vote but were not active. They were not activists, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you'll see more of them get involved, and I think you've seen some of that already. Certainly where I am here in Austin, Texas, we've seen people go out to the state capitol. When you talk to people and say, have you been in politics before? Many of them say no, other than voting. Mm-hmm. So they did vote, but they didn't take it to the next level. And that's the same with the Tea Party movement. Most of the activists that we worked with around the country were people that followed politics, who voted not every election, but tended to vote in the general elections. But we really turned them into grassroots activists that had a sustained campaign and movement for years.
Senator Bernie Sanders has said the Tea Party succeeded because, in part, it was funded by the Koch brothers, and the movement took off because it was backed by so much money and power. Is there truth to that? And how important was the money in terms of getting out your message as a Tea Party activist?
Yeah, I think Senator Sanders has it a bit wrong there in that the support kind of came later from national organizations. The movement started out very grassroots oriented. It was very organic. Yes, Freedom Works and myself had a lot to do with the early days, and that did take some financing. It took some staff to put in a lot of hours to get people organized. But most of the grassroots activists on the ground, the local groups that went out and protested in the early days of 2009, they were doing it. They were not paid. They were doing it on their own. And we really acted as kind of good customer service agents, if you will, for this movement. So, yeah, later on, groups like Americans for Prosperity and other Koch-funded groups did get involved and tried to get Tea Party activists to talk about the issues that the Kochs cared about. You know, they did take an active role, but that was actually later. And I think that, you know, people like to assign the blame or the credit to billionaires like George Soros on the left or the Kochs on the right. But I think it's a very simplistic way of doing mass movement.
Let's go to some calls. A lot of folks have been patiently waiting. Andy in Vallejo, you're on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I think the entire function of the protest has nothing to do with changing things politically within your city governance, but more people need to take on an identity. And so people don't really think, they feel. And by going out and expressing these social politics and these movements, it forms their social identity in our nation. And I think that's what's really lacking. And that's why people protest.
Fair point. Thanks for your call. Robert in Nevada, thank you for waiting patiently. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I'm going to second what was just said, that the identity, I support all of the protests that are out there. They are in line with my philosophies. So, but they're so factional. And I really like the point of identifying Trump as a celebrity and entering into a new era of popularity and following a cult. And it's not expressed on my political view of bringing somebody forward. And I'm very afraid for the country of saying we need a celebrity to carry the mantle. But to enunciate all of these different identities and bring it back to what I'm most afraid of losing the American ideal. It's all very un-American to me and very troubling. So I don't know how to bring everybody together to agree on the liberties that I think we stand for.
Robert, thanks for your call. Valid point. Abram Finkelstein in New York, take that. I mean, you've made some good points about identity politics and celebrity. You helped create that iconic Silence Equals Death logo. You didn't draw it up over a beer in 20 minutes. This took time and energy and focus, but it had a huge impact. Talk about, I guess, the icons and slogans and the impact that that might have on today's movement.
Thank you for throwing that to me. I was jumping out of my chair. I agreed with the last two callers. And in fact, I've been so stimulated by every conversation that's happening, I want another hour. But let's shift back to Silence Equals Death. I think that I've dropped into the comment about marketing and metrics and all of that. I think that Silence Equals Death, as an example of communicating in public spaces, is what all of the same marketing strategies that Donald Trump rode into office on, but detached from capital. And there's a huge difference. So when I spoke earlier in the program about image literacy, what I was trying to say is something similar to what the previous caller just mapped out, which is, is it a good thing or a bad thing that we're in the 21st century, we're looking for celebrities instead of elected officials? Well, elected officials have always been celebrities. What's different is we have computers in our pocket now. And in the 19th century, we had broadsheets on the street. So it feels different, but it actually isn't very different. And I think it's important to think strategically. To think critically and strategically about what's happening now in the continuum of how ideas are communicated. And in particular, in an image culture, we're surrounded by images, so we think we understand them, but they're really just like the backgrounds on a cartoon. They're the sky, rocks and trees of a social landscape. And most of us don't really have time to think about them. They just pass before us. So I think it's really important to pay very close attention to who's saying it, when they're saying it, what it's in reference to. Take what you can and throw the rest away.
We're talking about protest and dissent in the age of President Trump. I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in today for Forum. We get a lot of questions and comments. Joe writes in, Trump is vulnerable to protests and boycotts directed at his businesses. There should be a publicized boycott of Trump's commercial tenants and clients that hold events at his golf clubs, and there should be near-permanent protests at these locations. Shannon Coulter of Grab Your Wallet, what about his properties and Joe's comments there?
Yeah, his properties are on the boycott list. Unfortunately, I'm not a full-time investigative reporter, so I don't have unlimited bandwidth to do that kind of footwork and research 24/7, but I would love to, which is a part of why we're talking about forming a nonprofit.
You're talking about changing the movement now into a kind of formal nonprofit to take on corporate accountability?
Yeah, I mean, Exactly. And there's a lot of appetite on the part of consumers right now to understand how they can continue to flex their consumer power in ways that promote inclusion and respect. The first caller asked why we aren't more focused on elections and midterms and, you know, getting progressives back into seats of power. And the answer is that this is not a political movement. This is not a partisan movement. The name of the movement, Grab Your Wallet, has a cultural reference in it, not a political reference. For women, when those hot mic remarks came out, that was about our daily lived experience in the workplace and in our lives. That wasn't about political affiliation. So in many ways, this is the resistance is cultural in addition to being political. And we also saw that with the Women's March. And you know, another caller asked who the leaders of these movements are. Well, I think, you know, it's very important to mention that Fortune magazine just named the leaders of the Women's March among the most important leaders in the world. So that's Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, Carmen Perez, all women of color. And they're incredibly important in our culture right now as leaders.
Fair enough. We get a listener asked, does a successful social protest movement need to grab media attention? And Brendan Steinhauser, who helped get the Tea Party up and running, I want to go to you and ask you, you know, what was sort of the most important or most effective thing in getting people motivated and to rally behind the Tea Party and to get politicians to listen and respond? Was it media attention or did you go right to the politicians?
Well, it's a good question, and what's interesting is that I would argue the Tea Party movement started out as a sentiment out there that millions of people had. It was not a movement until Rick Santelli went on a rant on CNBC and sort of made some arguments about policies that President Obama was pursuing at the time, and I think it really struck a chord with a lot of people. But for the internet and but for the media coverage that we eventually got, I don't know that the Tea Party movement would have made it into a massive political protest movement and eventually an electoral force. So I do think media attention is extremely important, especially in the local communities. So, you know, most of our protests started out in urban areas. They started out in major cities, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Santa Monica, and they grew from there. But the only way to really reach into the suburbs and the rural areas was to get a ton of media coverage, to get lots of activity online so that people could find where these protests were happening, get connected, and then get plugged into their local chapters.
Let's take some more calls. Delilah in San Francisco, thank you for your patience. You're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really enjoyed the program so far. What I have not heard, which I'm surprised by is the continued militarization of the police. And the, you know, reluctance for people to really participate in protests as a result of that. You know, I live here in San Francisco. I go to many protests. I've gone to many Black Lives Matter protests where the police are in full riot gear, you know, tear gas, and very aggressive to protesters. So, I know that this militarization of the police is very new, this approach to treating protesters like criminals is very new. So just wondering if your panel can address that, and I'll take my call off the air.
Thank you. L.A. Kaufman in New York. Talk a little bit about the militarization of the police and this caller's maybe reluctance to take to the streets given that fact in some cities.
Yeah, I mean, that militarization has been underway for quite some time. It certainly dates back at least to the aftermath of the 1999 Seattle WTO protests. Some people trace it even earlier. So the longstanding transfer of kind of insane paramilitary equipment to local police forces all around the country, the adoption of all kinds of rules of engagement with street protests that are very aggressive. They're intended to have a chilling effect. They're intended to have exactly the effect that the caller just mentioned, to make people feel frightened and reluctant to be out in the streets. Obviously, there are many, many, many forms of political engagement, including Grab Your Wallet, where you don't have to take part in a street protest. But there's reason for real concern now, given the hostility overall of this administration to democracy and democratic values, the scale of the arsenals in the hands of the police, and the moves that we're seeing in many state legislatures around the country to introduce quite draconian anti-protest legislation, I think this is a very worrisome set of trends. We see, you know, counterbalanced against that the the day of protest, the Women's March, which is the largest day of protest in U.S. history, was an enormously peaceful outpouring. We're seeing that our movements are very nonviolent, are coming out of deeply felt values, and I think there's reason for concern. Down the road that as we continue to see people coming out in the streets in large numbers, that there's mm-hmm. going to be attempts to shut that down.
Danny in Santa Rosa, thanks for your patience. You're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. Listen, you know, there's been a real absence of looking at how oligarchical this whole situation is, how they create a problem by selling people weapons, selling people different kinds of gases and chlorines, all these other cesiums, all stuff that's allowed to be used in wartime. And then we blow it up. And then nobody knows who blew it up. So we create a war over the reaction from the problem. And it's been going on since, you know, we started believing George Bush with weapons of mass destruction, or his dad with terrorism. All these things are all being powered by the people who own this country, including the people who own all the radio stations and the TV stations and the media. So I think people really need to stop listening to the government's lies and talk people to people about truth. We've been in a military state since 1963, and I was kicked out of school for speaking against Vietnam. I was kicked off of stages as a speaker, as a stand-up comic. I was blackballed as an actor for speaking out actively and being an activist. So, you know, people are taking a lot of risks now that they're militarizing police, and they're taking a lot of risks with this two-party system, a right and a left wing of the same bird.
Okay, Danny, are you involved now in protests and dissent actively?
I am, and I'm still a stand-up comic, and I still speak out against violence. I speak out. I'm a Hispanic. Mm-hmm. I may be deported. You know, I mean, there's all these things. We've been battling against brown people for so long and black people for so long that people seem to have not seen the lines of the government takeover of people's minds, especially when if you saw a little child in Vietnam with her skin melting off, everyone wanted to stop the war. But now there's chlorine on babies, and we want to drop bombs, which are not chemicals, on babies.
All right, Danny, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Mary in San Francisco, got a lot of calls here. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What's your comment or question?
Well, one of the things I noticed during the last election was that the GOP website had an ability for local branches to upload all their local detail to that website. So it became a hub of information. And they also have things like how to talk to people about diversity, about the things that were issues in the election. And it centralized the protest and gave a focus to people that I think is lacking from the response to now.
Hmm. L.A. Kaufman, you want to take that in terms of organization today in the age of Trump? Who's taking the lead here, Rise and Resist? Who is out there organized? Who's got their act together?
Well, there's been really an enormous flourishing of local organizing projects, some of them coordinated nationally, some of them really coming from a purely grassroots place. The Indivisible Network, that's, of course, the guide that was written by some former congressional staffers drawing lessons from the Tea Party, which I actually really appreciated that Brendan mentioned that the Tea Party had first learned from the left. So cycling those lessons around. There's more than 5,000 Indivisible groups now around the country. There's initiatives. The ACLU has a new People Power initiative, which is setting up local groups all around the country that are doing work on some very concrete reforms around immigrant rights to expand the notion of sanctuary at the local level. I think we're seeing a lot of we're seeing those huddles that came out of the Women's March. We're seeing things like swing left, where people are looking for swing districts near them and looking for ways to engage politically in that work. So there's been this just, I think, huge, enormous flourishing of these local groups in what's now, you know, it hasn't been quite 3 months since the inauguration. Where all of that will go remains to be seen. But But in contrast to the caller who called our movements leaderless, I think actually what we're seeing is the rise of a leaderful form of organizing, where you're seeing many, many people being able to step up and take initiative, organize their local groups, download resources. That's one of the great advantages to doing this work in the internet age, is that there's so many training resources and strategy resources just simply available for the downloading or the viewing online, which is fostering a kind of small D democratic participation all around the country.
And we're going to take one more call. Anne in San Jose, thanks for your patience. You're on the air. We're running low on time. Anne, welcome.
Hi, I am doing something every day, but I did want to say that it seems like when they go low, we need to go high. And being anti-something isn't as powerful as saying, I want to create and I want to do this positive thing, and wouldn't it be good to do this? So a rally or demonstration versus the word protest, it seems to be a shift for me. And I just recently went to a workshop for AB 14, the California Clean Money Campaign, caclean.org. And they are focusing on one step at a time. This is what we're going to create, which is basically a NASCAR politician. We're going to label our politicians clearly and follow the money that they're speaking from like patches on the suit of a NASCAR driver.
And in San Jose says focus on the positive. We are running out of time. As Abram Finkelstein said, need another hour to talk through all this. So we'll have you all back. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us. We've been talking with longtime activist Abram Finkelstein and L.A. Kaufman, who joined us from our New York bureaus in New York. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We also talked with Republican strategist Brendan Steinhauser, also earlier by Mark Anthony Johnson of the Movement for Black Lives, and Shannon Coulter of Grab Your Wallet Boycott. Thanks again. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Eric Westerveld, in for Mina Kim. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.